You're listening to The Conversation. Amid the drones, ballistic missiles and tanks on parade in Beijing on September the 3rd, one image stood out. Xi Jinping, Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un walking shoulder to shoulder for the first time, on their way to watch a vast display of military hardware marking 80 years since the end of the Second World War. It was a show of strength and unity against the West. In his address, Xi said that the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation was unstoppable. Absent from the ceremony was Taiwan's leader, Lai Ching-te, who took to Facebook, writing that Taiwan does not commemorate peace with the barrel of a gun. China and Taiwan both claim their forces bore the true burden of Chinese resistance against Japan during World War II. Both use this history to lay claim to power and territory. But now China is weaponizing it, pushing for what it calls a correct perspective of the war as it seeks to reshape the world order.
By creating this spectacle around the memory of China's actions in defeating fascism in World War II, it can highlight its military and demonstrate how strong it will be going forward.
This is historian Meredith Oyen, and in this episode, she explains how disagreements between China and Taiwan over who fought the Japanese more than 80 years ago are still raging, and why China's military parade raised tensions with Taiwan up another notch. I'm Gemma Ware from The Conversation, an independent news and analysis platform partnering journalists with academics to help bring research knowledge to as many people as possible. Welcome to The Conversation Weekly, where experts explain how we ended up here. Meredith Oyen, you're a historian and an associate professor of history and Asian studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and you spent time living in both China and Taiwan, and you know the region and its fault lines, both historical and present, very well. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Let's begin, can we, in September 1945. Take us back to the moment when the war between China and Japan officially ended. What happened?
The end of the war came really fast, and it was unexpected by a lot of people on the ground, including a lot of the Chinese soldiers and citizens and Japanese soldiers and citizens in China. The combination of the two atomic bombs in Japan and the declaration that the Soviet Union was entering the war led to a very rapid decision to surrender from Japan. There was an official surrender on September 2nd in Tokyo.
The war against Japan ended as suddenly as it had begun.
There was a decision that there would be a formal ceremony in which the Chinese would accept the Japanese surrender. And that would happen in the Chinese national capital of Nanjing. The tricky part was that during the war, the Chinese government had evacuated Nanjing in December of 1937 when the Japanese army moved into the capital city of Nanjing. And that particular episode became notorious for the rape and murder of countless civilians. The Chinese government had spent the entire duration of the war in Chongqing, which is many miles northwest up the Yangtze River. And so they were moving back into their capital city that was overwhelmingly occupied by Japanese people and soldiers. And so they were moving into this territory at the sort of a handful of people coming to accept the surrender in what was essentially an occupied city. There was a short ceremony on September 9th. It was only about 20 minutes long, and it was Japanese military officials who were leading the Japanese army in China were surrendering to Chiang Kai-shek, who was the grand commander of the Chinese forces. He was the leader of the Republic of China, which we call Nationalist China. And they made some agreements that governed how the Japanese army would be then repatriated back to Japan.
And what was happening on the island of Taiwan at this point in 1945?
Taiwan had been under Japanese colonial control since 1895. World War II is really the second Sino-Japanese War in modern history. The first Sino-Japanese War was in 1894 and 95. And that war had ended with Japan taking control of Taiwan. So at the end of World War II, there's actually a second surrender ceremony in September, when the Japanese forces in Taiwan surrender to a nationalist official who has come over from mainland China and then begin the plan for pulling the Japanese forces out of Taiwan. That is a incredibly complicated process because the Japanese officials as a colonial government were not only occupiers in terms of the military, but they also controlled civil support services, the police, the post office, the schooling system. And so it was a multi-year process to actually remove all of the Japanese officials and individuals who were involved in the administration of Taiwan.
They'd been the colonial rulers for 50 years.
They had been.
Mm. They surrendered Taiwan to the Nationalist Republic of China at that point, not to any other forces.
Yes, they surrendered Taiwan to Chiang Kai-shek's forces. They didn't technically surrender it to a country. They surrendered it to the army. And so that's important when you talk about like the legal intricacies of the future of Taiwan.
So 1945, Japan and its colonial rulers leave Taiwan and it's taken under the control of the Republic of China. What was happening in mainland China at that point?
The war between the nationalist forces in China and the communist forces in China was decades long at this point. It had been interrupted by World War II and the United Front beginning in 1936, where they start negotiating a way to work together and pause the civil war so that they could face the Japanese threat. But there's a lot of tension between the two sides, and there is a lot of continued fighting that happens during the war itself. And so at the end of World War II, there's both the nationalists and the communists had control of different areas within China, and they each had a sense of what they had accomplished in those areas and what kind of fighting they had engaged in those areas. And then as a result of the withdrawal of Japan, the negotiations very quickly broke down for a unified government, and they began fighting directly against each other once again. That conflict continued until 1949, when it was absolutely clear that the nationalist Chinese forces could not recover. And at that point, they retreated to Taiwan in the hope of regrouping on Taiwan and then retaking the mainland, continuing the war, essentially. So 1949 was intended to be a pause in the fighting and a chance to regroup.
And in fact, that is the status quo that we've seen ever since.
That is the status quo. The Chinese Communist Party declared the establishment of the People's Republic of China on October 1st, 1949, and they have had control of the mainland ever since.
Today, all this history of the way China fought against Japan during World War II is deeply contested. What are the main areas of disagreement between China and Taiwan?
Yeah, there's a couple of them. One is there is a perennial debate about the extent to which each force, the communist forces and the nationalist forces, fought Japan and how well they fought Japan. So there was a longstanding criticism of the nationalist forces of being disorganized, ill-trained, underfed, often largely conscripted and forced into service, and a product of a very corrupt government under Chiang Kai-shek, and therefore largely inept at fighting the Japanese. And that narrative then in turn highlights the communist forces that were based in Yan'an in the area in the northwest of China and were out fighting skirmishes against the Japanese army. The nationalist government was the first government in the world to fight a fascist power in World War II and fought the longest. It's an 8-year war, some would say 14-year war in China, and not the shorter conflict that you see in Europe. And so they fought very hard and sacrificed very hard and had, in fact, put up the bulk of the resistance against Japan, sometimes very heroically, sometimes under very difficult circumstances over the course of the war. And that narrative sometimes will discount the Chinese communist contribution. So there was a recent statement from a nationalist representative in Taiwan, sort of highlighting the nationalist narrative that the communist forces were mostly concerned with land redistribution and addressing class issues and establishing communism in their region. And they were concerned with day-to-day operations, and maybe 10% of their energy was left over for dealing with Japan. So there's a real battlefront there in terms of who did more fighting and who was more distracted by their own growth or their own power as a result wasn't fighting the Japanese.
Where does the truth lie there?
It's both. The nationalist government had lots of issues with corruption and had lots of issues with conscription. It had a very chronically underfed army, and it fought quite a lot and led the fight against the Japanese. It fought very hard in Shanghai and Nanjing, and in a number of later set pieces, it fought in Burma in 1944. The communist forces were very concerned about shoring up their position in Yan'an. And there are also examples of Chinese communist forces fighting against the Japanese. The truth lies in nuance, right? That there's, in fact, a lot of examples of both heroic struggles and battles and ineptitude and corruption that you can find across the board. The complexity of the narrative has increased in recent decades. In China itself, there's been, since the 1980s, more recognition of the nationalist contributions to the cause, while also still highlighting the communist forces. But it's one where if there's a source of tension, it becomes an easy place to make accusations against each other.
Mm. One of the main areas of contention, as you say, is who did the most fighting against the Japanese. Are there any other areas of real dispute over World War II and its history?
Yeah, some of the decisions in World War II and some of the agreements, for example, the Cairo Agreement in 1943, becomes a flashpoint in terms of the future of Taiwan. In 1943, Chiang Kai-shek met Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill in Cairo. Churchill and Roosevelt were on their way to Tehran to meet Stalin to have a great power conference. And that was the important conference, the one in Tehran. But they stopped off in Cairo and met up with Chiang Kai-shek. The agreement there is essentially a press release. It's not legally binding, but it was an agreement that they were fighting together against the Japanese, that Japan would lose control over the territories that had gained by imperialist force. So it would lose territories like Taiwan. It would also no longer hold Korea. The statements there are fairly vague, and they became a source of longstanding dispute, not only about Taiwan, but also about the Diaoyu or Senkaku Islands chain, which is claimed by both China and Japan. So there is a real disagreement in how you interpret that agreement. Did Taiwan revert to China at the end of the war, or did it become occupied and revert to the Republic of China, and therefore People's Republic of China, the Communist China, never had a claim to it. So there's a lot of differences in how we interpret the future of Taiwan based on some of those agreements that are happening during and at the end of the war.
What steps has Communist China been taking to control or even rewrite the narrative about World War II as this 80th anniversary of its end approaches?
The celebration in Beijing on September 3rd is linked to the Shanghai Cooperation meeting, having this large meeting, which in turn is linked to Belt and Road, which is in turn linked to Xi Jinping's larger vision for China's foreign policy and role in the world.
In China, President Xi is hosting the leaders of more than 20 countries for what's known as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit. Among those in attendance is Russian President Vladimir Putin and India's Prime Minister Modi.
All of it is celebrating China as a major power internationally and a power that exists outside of the framework of the West. And so it sort of reconsiders the world order without centering it around American heroism in World War II and American leadership in the world in the Cold War and thereafter. Instead, creates this narrative in which China was, in fact, very heroic in World War II and instrumental in fighting the battle. And we celebrate that. And we also acknowledge how strong China is now, that it is a major leader that's inviting all of these other players to come talk about economics and security and the future of the region. And it has this great military might that it has built extraordinarily quickly over the last two decades, and that it has a major role to play in the world going forward. So I think it's all linked in that respect. China has been remembering World War II and choosing to really embrace its narrative of its role in World War II. And it's done that through these very big, very public celebrations. World War II is a sort of a critical moment in Chinese history, not just because of all the nationalist communist things that led to the Civil War and the founding of the People's Republic, but World War II marked the end of the colonial era in Asia, by and large. And it meant that the colonialist powers that were very involved in Chinese politics were forced out of the country towards independence. And then also that it was a major player on the world scene. As a result of its contributions in World War II, China gained a role in the Security Council of the newly established United Nations coming out of World War II. So it's a critical moment in the creation of a stronger China that has a voice in the world. And in recent years, this has been particularly important as China looks to carve out a space for itself in this multipolar world and ideally show an alternative to a world dominated by the United States and Western Europe. And so by creating this memory and this spectacle around the memory of China's actions in defeating fascism in World War II, it can highlight its military and demonstrate how strong it will be going forward. It can celebrate its importance as a major player in world politics. And so the commemoration of the war becomes very important on those levels.
Are there any specific ways that China has been trying to reestablish its own narrative about the war in these past few months leading up to this anniversary?
You've seen increased sort of recognition of the role of the communist forces in the fighting. There was a recent editorial in the People's Daily that talked about remembering the role of World War II and the importance of the history of World War II for China's national image. And the author there was talking about lamenting the tendency of nationalist scholars and people affiliated with the government on Taiwan to downplay the role of the communists in the war. That undercuts the truth and accuracy of what happened, and that it's important to know what really happened in order to recognize China. There is this steady release of information that says this was an important moment that established the Communist Party as working on China's behalf and working on behalf of the Chinese people. And this is a moment where China was clearly recognized as being a potentially important power in the world. And so you've seen a lot of recognition of that and a lot of commentary about that in the lead up to this anniversary.
Every week, Michelle Grattan offers you a ringside seat to the latest in Australian politics with interviews and insights from political insiders. On the Conversations Politics with Michelle Grattan podcast, we cut through the spin and get to the substance with independent analysis of the issues that really matter. Stay informed, search and follow Politics with Michelle Grattan wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. Meredith, China has held this huge military parade, and it's just come just after this big meeting, the Shanghai Cooperation meeting with a lot of world leaders, including Putin and the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. But it also invited a bunch of Taiwanese public officials to this event. Why did it want Taiwanese officials to be there?
From the perspective of communist China, Taiwan is absolutely an irrevocable part of the People's Republic of China. The people in Taiwan were part of the nation of China that fought against Japan and conquered Japan and succeeded in the war. So because they are part of this nation, they should be part of the celebration. Taiwanese representatives should be there. And so they extended an invitation and said that our Taiwanese compatriots should absolutely be part of this grand celebration because we are all one China.
And how did Taiwan react to the fact that some of its public officials had been invited?
Taiwan was less thrilled. So in Taiwan right now, there is a really fierce political divide between the nationalist Chinese, the party that came over from the mainland, and now 80 years later continues to have a thriving political party on Taiwan. But now there's an opposition party that is in the form of the Democratic People's Party, the DPP. And that party is in power right now. They hold the presidency. And so the executive government said that no Taiwanese officials, current or former, should be attending the military parade in Taiwan. The DPP comes from a perspective that Taiwan should have self-determination and that it should have the opportunity to become an independent nation, a Republic of Taiwan, perhaps, at least settle its own future without any influence from China. And so because of that perspective, they do not want their officials engaged in a communist Chinese propaganda spectacle. They also reminded Taiwanese celebrities that they should really strongly reconsider engaging in any of these activities. So like pop singers and actors were reminded that they should consider their long-term future, even if they're trying to build an audience in China, they should not necessarily engage in the celebrations that took place this week.
Is that because some were planning to?
There's always tension over pop culture between Taiwan and China. And there's always people who are willingly going over to build that audience. And then there's always pop stars in Taiwan who will do things like sing the national anthem at a presidential inauguration in Taiwan. This happened a number of years ago with a very prominent Taiwanese artist, and she was banned from touring on the mainland for years afterwards as a result. And so the cross-straits politics inject themselves into pop culture all the time.
Taiwan's been marking the end of the war in its own way. What's it been doing, and how does it relate to China's commemorations?
Yeah, the celebrations in Taiwan have been significantly more low-key. And there's been a lot of responding to the actions in China and pushing back, countering what they call the flawed historical narrative that's being put forward by Beijing.
And how much is World War II a general topic of conversation in both countries beyond just these military parades and the political ceremonies? Do these narratives about the war pop up in everyday Chinese conversations?
As somebody who lived in Nanjing for a number of years, certainly because of the history of what that city experienced during World War II, it was very common to have people talk about it. I had any number of cab drivers talk to me about the Japanese devils, especially at times of particular geopolitical tension between China and Japan. Whenever there was something in the news, that would come up particularly a lot.
Are there particular cultural representations of that war, even in the last few months, that are making headlines in both places?
Yeah, there's a huge movie out in China. It's a retelling of the story of the Nanjing Massacre, and it's following a group of people who hid out and were taking photos of the atrocities and smuggling them out to the Nanjing safe zone. That is based on a true story about how the images of the Nanjing Massacre got out to the rest of the world. That movie has been massive. World War II is always great fodder for entertainment, and that's true in the West as well. In Taiwan, I feel like the most recent geopolitically motivated major piece of film or television is this new series in August that is talking about a potential cross-strait invasion and is following people through their preparations for and the moments of an attack on Taiwan from China. And so that's using cinema and television to sort of work through the questions of what would that look like in Taiwan. And timed right on the anniversary, the release date for that series in Japan was on August 15th, which is the official date of the Japanese initial surrender.
How significant is this dispute over the narrative and the history of World War II in the wider tensions between Taiwan and China? Is it a flashpoint in that wider history, or is it really part of the root of the problem?
You know, it's easy to want to dismiss it as being a bunch of kind of history nerds nitpicking details about who fought who when with what weapon and what place. But I think the reason why it's such a perennial flashpoint is it goes to very deeply to questions about identity and China's role in the world and Taiwan's identity and what its future is going to be. And so it becomes a proxy for fighting all the rest of these battles that are very significant and could help determine the future of East Asia. World War II has this very long shadow in all of East Asia because there's a lot of unfinished business. And for China and Taiwan, this question of, are they two separate entities? Are they a divided nation? Is this one nation? Is there one China and Taiwan is part of China? This is a really significant geopolitical flashpoint. And that is something that stems directly out of World War II. And so in the tensions in the Taiwan Strait and the tensions over the future of Taiwan, you have a daily reminder of this period of warfare that then led to the circumstances that allowed the current situation to exist.
Thank you so much, Meredith, for explaining that history to us and why it's still so relevant today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for this week's episode of The Conversation Weekly. This episode was written and produced by Mend Marawani and me, Gemma Ware, with production assistance from Katie Flood. Sound design is by Eloise Stevens, and our theme music is by Nita Sol. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us directly at podcast@theconversation.com. You can also sign up for The Conversation's free daily newsletter by clicking on the link in our show notes. The Conversation is a non-profit news outlet dedicated to sharing the work of academic experts with a wider audience. If you like what we do, please support us at donate.theconversation.com, and please rate and review the podcast wherever you follow us. Thanks very much for listening.